Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate 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 Vasudevaya.
Vayana Namaskri Chandaram Chayvam Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Dato Jayam Udhirayet Nastabrayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Tamashvoke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, 3rd Canto, 15th Chapter, 50th Verse. Pradushchakarta
Yad
Idam Puruhuta
Rupam
Dinesha
Nirvritim
Abhapur
Aram
Drisho
Na
Asman
Idam
Bhagavate
Nama
Id
Idema
Yonatmanam
Hrudayo
Bhagavan
Patita
Pradushcha Kartaye Yadidam Puruhuta Rupam Pradushcha Kartaye Yadidam Puruhuta Rupam Tenesha Nirvritim Avapura Lam Drishona Tenesha Nirvritim Avapura Lam Drishona Tasma Idam Bhagavate Nama Id Videma Tasma idam bhagavate nama idvidema Yavnatmanam durudayo bhagavan pratita Pradushcha karta yadidam puruhuta rupam Tenesha nivritim avapura landrishona Tasma idam bhagavate nama idvidema Yavnatmanam durudayo bhagavan pratita Pradushcha karta yadidam tu puruhuta rupam Tenesha nivritim avapura lam drishona Tasma idam bhagavate nama idvidema Yavnatmanam durudayo bhagavan pratita Pradushcha karta yadidam puruhuta rupam Tenesha nirvritim avapura lam drishona Tasma idam bhagavate nama idvidema Yavnatmanam durudayo bhagavan pratita
Pradushcha karta yadidam puruhuta rupam Tenesha nirvritim avapura lam drishona Tasma idam bhagavate nama idvidema Yonatmanam durudayo bhagavan pratita Pradushcha karta yadidam puruhuta rupam
Jakarta,
you have manifested.
Yat,
which,
idam,
this,
Puruhuta,
O greatly worshipped,
Rupam,
eternal form,
Tena,
by that form,
Isha,
O Lord,
Nibritim,
satisfaction.
Avapu,
obtain.
Alam,
so much.
Visha,
vision.
Na,
are.
Tasmai,
unto him.
Idam,
this.
Bhagavate,
unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Namaha,
obeisances.
Eat
only.
Videma,
let us offer.
Ya,
Anatmanam,
of those who are less intelligent.
Durudaya,
cannot be seen.
Bhagavan,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Pratita,
has been seen by us.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada.
O Lord, we therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto your eternal form as the Personality of Godhead, which you have so kindly manifested before us. Your supreme eternal form cannot be seen by unfortunate, less intelligent persons, but we are so much satisfied in our mind and vision to see it. O Lord,
We therefore
offer our respectful obeisances
unto your eternal form
as the Personality of Godhead,
which you have so kindly
manifested before us.
Your supreme
eternal form
cannot be seen by unfortunate,
less intelligent persons,
but we are so much satisfied
in our mind
and vision
to see it.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada.
The four sages were impersonalists in the beginning of their spiritual life, but afterwards, by the grace of their father and spiritual master, Brahma, they understood the eternal spiritual form of the Lord and felt completely satisfied. In other words, the transcendentalist who aspire to the impersonal Brahman or localized Paramatma are not fully satisfied and still hanker for more. Even if they are satisfied in their minds, still, transcendentally, their eyes are not satisfied. But as soon as such persons come to realize the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they are satisfied in all respects. In other words, they become devotees and want to see that form of the Lord continually. It is confirmed in the Brahma Samhita that one who has developed transcendental love of Krishna by smearing his eyes with the ointment of love sees constantly the eternal form of the Lord. The particular word used in this connection, anatmana, signifies those who have no control over the mind and senses, and who therefore speculate and want to become one with the Lord. Such persons cannot have the pleasure of seeing the eternal form of the Lord. For the impersonalists and the so-called yogis, the Lord is always hidden by the curtain of yoga maya. Bhagavad Gita says that even when Lord Krishna was seen by everyone while he was present on the surface of the earth, the impersonalists and so-called yogis could not see him because they were devoid of devotional eyesight. The theory of the impersonalists and so-called yogis is that the Supreme Lord assumes a particular form when he comes in touch with Maya, although actually he has no form. This very conception of the impersonalists and so-called yogis checks them from seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead as He is. The Lord, therefore, is always beyond the sight of such non-devotees. The four sages felt so much obliged to Him, to the Lord, that they offered their respectful obeisances unto Him again and again. Thus then the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, 15th chapter, Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Description of the Kingdom of God. Om Ajnanatimanandasagaranandana Salakaya Chakshuramilitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupakadamayam Tirati Svapadantikam. This last sentence in the purport is very significant in that the Kumaras, it is said, felt very obliged to the Lord. They felt so obliged that they offered their obeisances again and again. One who realizes the mercy of the Lord and who depends fully upon the mercy of the Lord, one of the six symptoms of surrender is Sharanagati by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, feels a great debt of gratitude. And it's a debt that the sages say can never be repaid fully. This is the same debt that Krishna said that he had to the gopis. It's a great debt that I, try as I might, can never repay. A devotee feels that the mercy of Krishna is so great that it can never be repaid, even though one may engage in many lifetimes of devotional service, many different endeavors and activities to enact some kind of reciprocation. The gratitude that can be expressed is very limited, because in fact we are limited beings. But the devotee understands that everything comes from the Supreme Lord. There is nothing that human beings invent. There is nothing original under the sun, sometimes it is said. The devotee feels that I've been given so much, I can never repay everything. And of course, the repayment is devotional service. That in itself is very pleasing and very satisfying to not only to the devotee, but also to Krishna. Prabhupada writes in the first canto that the relationship, in one of his purports, between the servitor and the served is the most confidential form of intimacy. Everyone is looking for intimacy for a perfect relationship, for happiness with others. This originates between the living entity and Krishna, because everybody is a part and parcel of Krishna, and everyone has a relationship with Krishna as Ampita Bhridhapita, as one who is generated by Krishna, one who is a son or daughter of Krishna, and Mame Vamso Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. One is eternally related to Krishna as his part and parcel. So to return everything by way of reciprocation or by acting in a...
We try to experience the beauty of the deity and the beauty of the descriptions in the Indian. But here it's just never, there's no cessation, there's no end to it. It's something beyond our senses. So this is kind of what this verse and purport are all about, that Krishna is the Yogshija. He's beyond what our ordinary senses can see. Now, we can see something very beautiful, and our material senses can see it and register it as very beautiful. But something else happens when we see the Supreme Lord, something that becomes an unending quest, something that we, like Parikshit, he was never satisfied. Parikshit means one who is always looking for,
trying to
rediscover Krishna. It becomes a form of samadhi, a deep meditation, a longing.
That
this beauty is so great
that I want to see it over and over again.
It's like an unquenched thirst. It's kind of like, you know, being out in the desert or some place where the sun is beating down and the temperature is soaring up above 40 or 50 degrees. And you just
never get enough.
I don't know if you've ever been dehydrated.
I got dehydrated once.
In California. And I didn't realize that I got dehydrated. And I didn't know if I was going to make it. It was a very, very hot day, and there was no shade, there were no trees. And so somehow I managed to get back down to where there was a stream, and I began to drink the water. And I must have drunk 2 gallons of water. That's like 8 liters or something like that. I still wasn't feeling. And I meant all for hours and hours afterwards, I still couldn't drink enough water. I kept drinking and drinking water. I finally got back down to the edge of the cabin. But that's the kind of
thirst
that they talk about. That's the kind of desire of wanting that they have for Krishna. They just keep, they never get satisfied. The more they have, the more they want. The more they see Krishna, the more they want. So this is what converted these impersonalists, the Kumaras. They were noted to be immersed in impersonalism. When they saw the beauty, when they smelled the tulsi flowers, and then when they saw the beauty of the Lord, they just felt that they couldn't get enough. So again and again they offered their obeisances.
They just wanted always to see that beauty of the Lord.
So this verse is talking about how people are, first of all, they can't see Krishna. Just like the taste of water, it's very wonderful, but we don't really, we'd rather have the produce there. One of those nice drinks. But Krishna says, I am the taste of water. There's nothing more perfect, there's nothing more pure than water. There's nothing more beautiful to see than Krishna. But as it is said, Krishna is not so cheap and easily understood or perceived by everyone. He has an effulgence that we read about in the Upanishad. He prays that, please remove this effulgence. Effulgence for that, so I can see their beautiful face. So Krishna has this curtain of Maya around him, and he's not easily seen. It's said that when Krishna was actually here 5,000 years ago, Prabhupada speaks about how only a few dozen or a few hundred, sometimes a few hundred people actually understood him or what he was and really appreciated him. So a devotee is an exceptional personality. When it's said that one in thousands and thousands actually wants to see Krishna, and out of those, only the one in thousands actually knows Krishna, there is great meaning. It's not only a matter of seeing and knowing, but realizing. So to realize this is the Supreme Godhead, it's not an easy thing. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasha Sarvasha Yogamaya Samadhi, that there is a veil that is covering that those who do not want to or do not have the determination to know me cannot know my absolute nature, my
In another verse, he talks about how he is Asuram Balamashutam. He's beyond this word of yakta is used. Sometimes it means different things. It means the curtain, it means the irreproachable, the unseeable Krishna, the unmanifest version of Krishna. So sometimes he is not known. And in general, people do not know him. When he was present on earth, he was thought to be a very powerful person, a very great warrior, a very intelligent, very crafty individual, someone who was empowered in different ways, who was given some special sanction to do some work, maybe a very powerful demigod. But very few people actually knew who Krishna was. And to this day, very few people, even those who follow Vedic culture, don't know who Krishna is. When I first came to this country as a missionary, we used to visit homes where there were deities of Krishna alongside the deities of Shiva and Parvati and Ganesh and Lord Brahma and others. And they were all more or less worshipped on an equal level. But these were the people thought that these are the deities, the gods that we worship. And they're all more or less, you know, we can kind of choose which ones we want to choose, go with ones we want to go with. But there was no special prerogative given to Krishna. So when Prabhupada started the Vigraha worship in a very magnificent and very big way, some people didn't understand or didn't appreciate why so much great attention. So many millions of pounds have been spent on flowers over the past years. Some people don't understand why. You know, why are you spending so much? So this is another concept of impersonalism. They said God is all pervasive. It's not just in Vedic culture, but all over the world, that God has an all pervasive aspect. They use verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam to talk about God's all-pervasive aspect. You say, well, if God is all-pervasive, then there's no need to spend elaborately on flowers in the temple because, you know, he's everywhere. He's everywhere. Might as well worship him in a human being or in a piece of metal or in a stone. So sometimes the deity worship that Prabhupada established, the worship of Arshavigraha, is criticized or condemned, that it is too elaborate. Krishna is everywhere, so why should we single him out as being amazing? Prabhupada's answer to that is that, of course, Krishna is in the deity, but he's more in the deity, because the deity is made special by the worship that deity is given. And the deity is actually someone in whom Krishna personally comes and manifests himself, not an ordinary thing. We have so many cases of deities, speaking deities, walking, Sakshi Gopal deities, witnessing, deities moving, deities drinking milk, maybe drank milk recently. Devotees have told me that in Vrindavan that deities of Krishna drink milk. They have so many eyewitness accounts of that. So that is the meaning of deity. The deity is somebody very beautiful and somebody very special. But one who refuses or who has this impersonalistic concept that God is everywhere will not appreciate deity worship. There's this saying that Prabhupada used to tell us, that if someone's asleep, they can be awakened. But if they pretend they're asleep, they cannot be awakened. So if someone actually doesn't want to see Krishna, then it's very difficult. Very, very difficult. And this is the case with many people. It's due to a large part to envy, which is our original sin, so to speak. But I don't want to see that there's another human-like being that is all perfect in every respect, that has every part of the mind, every part of the body is perfect. And there is no such a person, because I want to be perfect. And this is one of the root causes of our fall as human beings, of our failure to be in the spiritual world, of our unknown need to be in the spiritual world. So Krishna hides himself, but to a devotee, he's immediately manifest. Even if that devotee is not a great scholar, Preman Jana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena, Prabhupada refers to this verse, that if the eyes are smeared with love, then one can appreciate the beauty of Krishna and the
all-pervading aspect of Krishna, and Krishna as the fountainhead of all existence. Manjana Charita Bhakti Vilochana. Bhagavan sings this verse. And it signifies that one can, as Madhavendra Puri was the kind of, we might say, founder of conjugal love in the modern day, one can be immersed, imbued with love of Krishna by, like, Mother Yashoda and Mother Devaki and so many others, just by seeing the beauty of Krishna, or even just by hearing about the transcendental activities, the transcendental mercy of Krishna. There's the story of Pundarika Vidyanidhi, which you probably know, but it's worth repeating again sometimes. He was thought to be by some as very materialistic. Radha Arpandik was very suspicious of him. So when he was taken to meet Pundarika Vidyanidhi, he saw him surrounded by so much opulence. He had these very highly polished brass spittoons, silk beds, very beautiful tapestries hanging from the wall, long black hair with sandalwood oil, so it was all shiny and perfumed and dressed in silks, and having very opulent furniture in his home, and carpets, surrounded by servants, all, you know, waiting on his regimental. So I thought, oh, this is a materialist. When he heard one verse that Murari sang about Krishna from the 10th canto acting in his very mystical way with Putana, that he, in the verse it says that even though he killed Putana as a child, he also liberated her because she acted as his mother. So when Pundarika heard this verse, Pundarika Vidyanidhi, he became very absorbed tears began to flow from his eyes when he began to hear about how merciful the Supreme Lord was, that he just heard, yes, Krishna is very kind. He's liberating this demoness who has come to kill him. He became very moved. And then he began to manifest symptoms that were beyond ordinary understanding. He began to tear at his clothes and began to rip his silken shirt and his cloth and his dhoti and began to fall off his chair and ride around on the floor and started kicking all of his furniture and his brass work. And he actually kicked some of the chairs and the sofas apart. And he was just writhing around like a complete madman. And it took 10 of his men to restrain him. They were pulling and pushing and tackling him. And they finally were able to bring him back to normal consciousness. And it was this unusual display. We don't recommend these kind of displays, by the way. That he showed, not at all ordinary. And of course, he's not an ordinary person. He's an incarnation of one of the great servants of the Lord in the spiritual world. It convinced Gadadhar Pandit that here is not an ordinary person. He may look like a materialist, but actually just by hearing, he became some emotional thing took over, some subjective, very irrational element, this discovery that this is actually Krishna, that he is the most wonderful person in the world, took over his whole mind and his senses, and he lost it, as we say, from a material point of view, and became immersed in love of God. So Gadadhar Pandit became convinced that he was a great Mahabhagavat, a great spiritual person, and eventually became his disciple. So just to hear about the merciful aspect of Krishna, what to speak of seeing him personally and experiencing it directly, is very, very powerful, and can evoke transcendental emotions in one who is transcendentally situated, even though externally it may not appear that one is situated in a spiritual position. So Krishna's body is transcendental. It appears to be made of ordinary things, made of vile mucus, bones, and so on. But actually, it's described in the Upanishad that Krishna's body is without veins. It's not an ordinary body. It's a body composed of Satchitananda, of knowledge and bliss and eternity. As of all of the beings in the spiritual world, their bodies are composed of spirituality. But people didn't perceive this. They thought, oh, here's an ordinary person. He's a chariot driver. He's a friend of the Pandavas. He's a whatever they thought. They thought so many things. He's a great personality. But they didn't realize that he has a completely transcendental body. So again, Krishna is with his
Maya Jivani Kachanam, there's another verse in which Queen Kunti is talking about how Krishna is covered, not visible to the ordinary person, and that he is not easily approached because he's not understood properly. So people don't approach Krishna properly. They don't know how to approach him. So therefore he is sometimes hidden. And when he is enraged sometimes, like in the case of Lord Nrisimhadeva, even the demigods, they didn't know how to approach him. They didn't know how to satisfy him. Because here is the Lord in his fierce form. And what did they do? They had to ask Prahlad Maharaj to represent them, to go forward and pacify them. Because because they have some tinge of material desire, had to ask the pure devotee, "No, you go forward and pacify the Lord." Here were all these very great demigods who had come to see, to have darshan of the Lord. And they were pushing a 5-year-old boy ahead of them. "You go and pacify the Lord." And he was a little irate with Lord Brahma. He even said to him, according to one of Prabhupada's lectures, that "you gave out your boons too easily. You caused me a little difficulty. I couldn't kill him by day or by night. Couldn't be by man or beast. Couldn't be in land or sea or air. Couldn't be by weapons that were human made," and so on and so forth. So he was critical, even then, of Lord Brahma, who has this great position of engineering the whole universe. So again, it's difficult to approach Krishna in ordinary consciousness unless one has a certain attitude. Either one has understanding of who Krishna is, or can have both, or one has an emotional attachment to Krishna. And when I say emotional, it means transcendentally emotional, that one feels that Krishna can provide everything, that Krishna is the supreme, he is my father, he is the provider of the whole universe, and from him everything emanates. With that attitude, it's very, very easy to actually perceive Krishna. In one of Prabhupada's purports, he talks about how the impersonalists say we should see Krishna everywhere. And Prabhupada talks about how we should see the Supreme Lord in everyone as Paramatma. And therefore, everyone should be offered respect. And the vision of the Majjhima Adhikari is that we respect everyone. There are all different grades of human beings and non-human beings. But a devotee has great reverence and great respect for everyone. So when this concept of non-violence is floated around, it's not actually properly understood, nor is it properly carried out. People try to be non-violent to people they like, but they have to be violent to people that are threatening them. In some cases, it's necessary to be violent. You have to have a police force. You have to protect yourself. But actual non-violence is seeing that there is Paramatma in everyone, not just a Krishna soul pervasive, but there's a soul that can be reached in the heart of every living being. A couple of years ago, I was a guest on a radio program in Los Angeles. It was a radio program that went across about half the country, and I was on part of a panel with a priest, a Catholic priest, someone from the Episcopal, it's like the Church of England in America, a priest, and a rabbi. And the question of the day, this was like a 2 or 3 hour program with people phoning in, was that if someone is sadistic, they were talking, there was some kind of a serial killer on the loose in those days, one who killed about 15 or 20 people, they hadn't found him yet. But the idea was, can such a person be redeemed? That was the question. Can you hate such a person? Are you allowed to hate people like that in your religion? So this was a very long discussion, and people phoned in and asked lots of questions. So I think I was the only one of the four of us that said that we'd have to forgive such people, and we really couldn't hate even such people because they had the potential to become pure devotees. So that was a pretty difficult thing to swallow. And it took a few hours before the idea started getting across that everyone has potential. And then one of my arguments was, why do we have prisons anyway? Well, we have prisons to keep people out from doing it again so they can't go out for the same crime. But we also, I mean, the main reason is, the proper reason at least, is to reform people so that they'll stop being misbehaved and they'll be transformed from bad to good. And this is, as I was saying, the reformatory method of Krishna consciousness, to reform everyone who is acting in the wrong way to acting in the right way. So then we got into a whole discussion about what's wrong and what's right, and morality and immorality, and a very deep discussion followed. One who is impersonalist tends to think that I can do anything. One of the reasons for impersonalism is that I want to be libertine. I want to let my senses direct me in whatever way I want to go, and it's all one. And this is a reason why many great thinkers have embraced impersonalism, because it's a very convenient way to say everything is everything and I'm one. And once when Prabhupada was asked this, he said, well, isn't everything one? It was at College University, at Stanford University. And Prabhupada's immediate rejoinder was, why don't you eat your father? Just like that, why don't you eat your father? And it brings out all of the discrepancies and all the shortcomings of this concept of God being everything. That if God is everything, you can do everything, and everything is okay, and there's no good or bad. It's, you know, there's all sorts of things that happen. And then the other thing is that I am God, or that my guru is God. Prabhupada chastised some of his own disciples once for saying that he was God. It's a major controversy that went on way back in the first couple of years of his God. But some devotees were saying that Prabhupada is God. He knows everything. He's the fountainhead of everything. He's Krishna, basically. So Prabhupada had to take some rather drastic steps to rout out this idea people have. Devotees who become imbued with love for Krishna, they're not lacking in anything. Sometimes it is thought that someone becomes fanatical and they think Krishna is everything. Krishna is my father, Krishna is my lover, Krishna is my friend, Krishna is everything to me, that they become kind of imbalanced. And we read about the lives of the great sages, that they're completely unconscious of their body, they're wandering around naked sometimes. We read about some of them, or they just don't care. But we find that the devotees are of course, we're living at a time when there are many social conventions converging on us. But we as Prabhupada and his spiritual master in Bhaktivinoda Thakur as examples of how we are directed to conduct ourselves in the modern world. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had so many secular responsibilities, and we saw pictures of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati sitting in a big British convertible with a fancy coat and a turban on, and, you know, preaching somewhere. And Prabhupada set that example too, of making sure that our books were all in order, that there was no polygamy in ISKCON, and that we followed all the rules and so on and so forth. So there's an interesting section in the, I think it's called the Shikshastakam. It's a work by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in which he talks about what a paramhansa is. And he specifically says that those who are not paramhansas have to do certain things in order to, they have to observe four items with great attention. These four items are maintaining the body properly, stimulating the mind properly so that it's always satisfied, being satisfied socially, both individually and collectively, and studying the shastra for the upliftment of human society. So he said that unless you are a paramhansa, that and you want to be advanced in Krishna consciousness, all of these things have to be satisfied. Of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was very powerful, a great lover of Krishna, able to defy the likes of Vibhishana and other pretenders who were there. But he was also an example of someone who utilized the principle of Yuktam Vairagya. He could invent things, he could live in a big house, he could have lots of children, he could be a magistrate, and still he wrote voluminously dozens and dozens and dozens of books in Bengali and English, which were all meant to deepen one's understanding, and did, of Krishna consciousness. Once I went to the British Library to find, I heard, oh, Bhaktivinoda, he's very prolific, he's going to read his books. So I looked, I couldn't find anything there. not Bhakti Vinod Thakur. So then I started thinking, oh, well, he had he was Kedarnath Dutt. So then when I looked him up under Kedarnath Dutt, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of books. Wonderful, wonderful books that he wrote. So he was a great soul who set an example for all of us. And someone who was, although completely imbued and seeing Krishna from these non-rational points of view, still observed many of the customary conventional things that we sometimes tend to neglect. So I'll read the verse again. Pradushchikarta yadidam puruhuta rupam tenesha nirvritam avapuralam vishona tasma idam bhavagate nama idvidema yonatmana durudayo bhagavan pratita. O Lord, we therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto your eternal forms, the personality of Godhead, which you have so kindly manifested before us. Your supreme eternal form cannot be seen by unfortunate, less intelligent persons, but we are so much satisfied in our mind and vision to see it. So, comments, questions? What does it mean by social conventions? There's a passage in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm sorry, it's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's part of a purport by Prabhupada, in which he says that we read of great sages who had no outer consciousness of social conventions. But as long as we are living in the material world, we unfortunately must abide by them. This is the desire of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So these things have to do with very simple kind of common sense things. Like, well, for example, to get the visitation at the manor, we didn't just do it. We got permission from it. We had to fight for it, but we went through the channels. We didn't become gorillas and just have public worship anywhere. We decided to play the game. We go through the convention of getting sort of in writing by the Minister of the Environment. The way we, social conventions are things to do with the way we deal with the government, the way we personally deal, the way we dress, the way we talk to people, the way we look, the way we act, the way we present Krishna consciousness, the way for example, we're making very nice grounds here as we want, and we're giving easy access. We think it's easy access to the school children because these are conventions. It's a convention to educate young people. So we make it part of our life to provide syllabus or syllabi for young people to show that this is the way you can learn about this. Consciousness becomes a learning process, not just a somewhat obscure method of worships a foreign god, but it becomes an educational process. So that's a convention. Learning and education are a convention, which are acceptable in society. So when we develop curricula that are educational, then we are fitting into a convention, we might say. It's also somewhat of a convention to think that you should be green and that you shouldn't have to be overly dependent on machines. And it's becoming a convention. So if we show that we use ox power and that we try to grow our own, we try to be self-sufficient in some parts of the world, we are gaining that reputation in some of our farms, then that's also a kind of a convention that people adhere to. We don't have to be overly dependent. And we are conventional in the sense that we act as if we are dependent on things like petroleum. We use cars, we use computers, which are made from machines that, I mean, are made from things that use petroleum. So maybe our goal is to teach people ultimately they don't need these things, but we're acting in conventional ways by using them. And so it's part of that is Yukta Vairagya. So these are the conventions. These are some of the conventions. In other words, as Prabhupada said, we appear to be doing things in an ordinary way. We're repairing cars, we're cooking, we're painting, we're singing. We do everything that people do, but there's something different about it. So in a sense, to most people, just like they don't see Krishna, really, it appears conventional. Oh yeah, they're fixing their cars, they're cleaning their building, they're growing flowers in their garden. they cut their lawn, they use machine. Do we use a machine to cut the lawn? Do you use electric or a gas power? Yeah, they have a really nice system for mowing the lawn. There's a place in Delhi called Lily Garden. And it has lots of ashok and neem trees, and banyan trees, and palm trees in it. It's about 7 acres. There's a lot of lawn there. And they mow the lawn. They have these beautiful bullocks pulling the mowers. And then they eat the grass that they mowed. They don't have any machines cutting the grass in this whole place. It's very, very nice. Something you can do with bullock power. I mean, you have to learn how to do it, but anyway, whether you're using bullet power or machines, it's a convention from one perspective or another. It's kind of a convention. So it's a preaching tool to use a convention, to abide by a convention. People think, oh, they're Krishnas, but they're doing something. They're doing something ordinary. So maybe I can also be one of them. So it's a way of reaching out. That's why we always tell the devotees to wear the same color socks. If they can't dress, then they can't do anything. It's kind of a bad habit we've developed over the years, wearing different color socks. I think we don't do it anymore. But. And Prabhupada once told me, he said in England, because I had a soiled coat and I was sitting in front of him when we were first come over here. He said, in England, you dress, then undress. He said, you understand? You dress, then... So that's a very, very, very big convention. People check you out and look you up and down. And see how you look. If you have a wrinkled belly, not very good. Not in this country anymore. Maybe in India you can do it. So that's a very, very, very big convention. People check you out and look you up and down and see how you look. If you have a wrinkled dhoti, not very good. Not in this country anymore. Maybe in India you can be a sadhu, but can't be one. Any other questions? We see God every day. That's one way we can answer them. We have a deity in the temple. We have pictures that we see, and so you can also see that, at least on that level. And we also see from within, we see by internal vision. We understand that there's a manifestation of God in the heart of every living being. So we see God in all people, we see God in all non-human living things. And we try to see more and more that aspect of God. So it depends when they say we've seen God, what do they mean? But we can say that we've seen God because we know what God looks like. At least we have beauties, we have pictures, and even though we may not see the innermost God, the way Kumara saw God face to face, we do see some form of God. So that's usually what I answer. There's so many things we can say, but if the person is intelligent enough to ask a question like that, then we can give them some good answers.
and we can give them the opportunity to see God also. And gives us an opportunity to speak about who God is. That is a form, that is a form that we can paint, that we can worship, that we can see. And we can talk about that form of God. That has a form that has activities and entourage and paraphernalia. And one of the interesting things here is that we don't even have to see God Himself. We can see Adaranam Sarvesham Vishnu Adaranam Param Tasmat Paradanam Devi Tariyanam Samarcham. Parvati says that we can just see things connected with Krishna. And that is as good as seeing Krishna. We can see a peacock better. We can see the tulsi. Or like these kumaras, they smell the tulsi. Just by even smelling the tulsi, one can see. So if we see Krishna's paraphernalia, that's also another way of seeing God. If we see God's temple, if we see God's devotee, we also see God. That's another way to see God. Amadar. If we're in association of non-devotees, how do we protect ourselves and bring them closer to Krishna? Prabhupada gave an example. Once he was asked a question in Los Angeles by a lady who said, I have children, I live a long ways from the temple, I don't come here. This was her question, very often. But I feel that I should come and do some cooking for the deities, do some sewing, and that would help me. So Prabhupada's answer to that question was that if you live a long ways from the powerhouse, or if you live very close to the powerhouse, when you switch on the light, it's the same. It goes on. If you have a very tight connection to Krishna, he said, then your understanding of who Krishna is, your ability to protect yourself, in other words, or your ability to preach Krishna consciousness, should be very powerful. As powerful as one who is in more close association with devotees. Now, of course, we know that one should associate as much as possible. This is one of the important points that Rupa Goswami says that we should do, is we should be in one of the 5 points, be in an atmosphere that's full of devotees. But Prabhupada gave this answer, because it's understood that only a minority of people can actually live in close association with a lot of devotees. It's understood that the number of devotees, initiated and uninitiated, who are existing in the world as Prabhupada's movement expands, are the ones who don't live in the temples are going to increase and increasingly outnumber the devotees who live right in the temple atmosphere. That's just a fact of life that's taking place at the moment. Therefore, it'll be incumbent on all of those devotees to have a very tight connection with Krishna, because of that distance. And it's also a fact that there are some devotees who live a distance away from others. And they're, it's like Pundarika Vidyanidhi, he was manifesting as a materialist, but who are more advanced than some devotees that are living inside. And that's not the general rule necessarily. It's not general rule, but Prabhupada is making the point that if you follow the principles of reading and chanting and hearing, and deity worship, then you can become very, very fixed in Krishna consciousness. And that should be an impetus to go deeper rather than inhibiting that. That was the answer. Yeah. Well, that's why Prabhupada emphasized so much deity worship, that we have to chant, we have to see. I mean, we can't actually see Krishna by reasoning and logic. We can sort of hover around Krishna and get some superficial ideas about who Krishna is, but ultimately it comes down to we have to have faith that there is Krishna, and that when we're seeing the deity or a picture of Krishna, that's also Krishna. And develop love for that deity, for that nature. That's ultimately what has to happen. Prabhupada was kind enough to give us many different ways to induce all kinds of people, even those who are very logical and empirical, like the Bhakti Raya Institute. He gave even very hardcore empiricists an opportunity to come to Krishna, philosophers, psychologists, religionists, people who in some ways were distant from Krishna. He gave them the opportunity. So we just have to seize these opportunities and use them as best we can and try to induce everyone to chant and to hear and to see. Anything else? I'm going over the time, aren't I? I think this is a good last question.
Sometimes devotees used to go dry up and the devotees used to catch them and talk to them. And then again,
So the question was, police sometimes stop us from Harinam, and that's breaking a social convention. But Prabhupada's statement in Chaitanya Charitamrita is a general principle. In other words, we drive on the left side of the road. You know, we generally do the things that we're supposed to do. But when it comes to, there's exceptions. And sometimes, by breaking conventions, which are exceptional cases, those conventions change. Like Lord Chaitanya, he was the founder of the simple disobedience movement. Prabhupada writes about it. Even though in the very same book, he says that we have to follow conventions. But by breaking that convention of carrying on Harinam in a public way, the convention changed and it became okay, it became legal. So similarly, Prabhupada has done the same thing with Harinam. In Australia, I remember that we got so many fines and got thrown in jail so many times, and it was reported to Prabhupada so many times that he said, look, he said, if they stop you and they put you in jail, don't give them a penny. Just chant Hare Krishna in jail. Don't give them any money. And the purpose of, one of the main purposes maybe is the purpose of rounding up devotees and putting them in jail was to get revenue for the government. Well, they didn't get any revenue. So that, coupled with the fact that we were chanting in jail, annoyed them. And it has become so conventional, as opposed to non-conventional, to chant right in Australia that people, even the police and everybody, they like it. They think it's an addition. It's a welcome thing that people chant on the streets. So what formerly was an infraction of the law has now become something that adds to the social well-being of the country. That's the way, and I think that's happened here to a large extent. I mean, I used to go every day for a year and a half, and up and down Oxford Street, 8 hours a day, approximately. And, you know, we used to go to the court every now and then for obstructing traffic and upsetting the horses that were on police horses. And, but now it's kind of like, as long as, you know, you're not playing the cymbals in the horse's ears, and you're not causing people to spill out into the street and block the traffic and get hit by cars, they like it. And the shopkeepers used to come out, and if we didn't show up one day, they'd say, where were you? You were singing yesterday. So people became very attached to us. And grudgingly, or however, the authorities also, you know, they liked it, they appreciated it. And even though there's an occasional roundup, I think we kind of established a convention with Harina. Right? I mean, we go out with large numbers of devotees on the weekends. Okay. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Gokulananda ki jai.